Good afternoon. Good afternoon. Good afternoon and welcome. Welcome to the joint presentation of the classes of 1961 and 1976 on the pending issue of affirmative action in college and university admissions. My name is Earl Dudley. I'm a member of the class of 1961. And it is my pleasure to moderate the discussion this afternoon between the two gentlemen on either side of me. To my left is Paul Smith of the class of 1976. Paul is a partner in the Washington office of the law firm of Jenner & Block. He graduated summa cum laude from Amherst, went on to Yale Law School, and then clerked on the Second Circuit for Judge James Oakes, and at the Supreme Court for Justice Lewis Powell. He is an outstanding and very well-known practitioner in areas such as civil rights, First Amendment, and election law. He has argued 19 cases before the Supreme Court of the United States, the most famous of which probably was the case of Lawrence against Texas, which overruled the court's earlier decision in Bowers against Hardwick and held that sexual contact between members of the same gender is constitutionally protected. On my right is my classmate and longtime friend, Bert Rhein, of the class of 1961. He is a founding partner in the law firm of Wiley Rhein in Washington. Bert, too, graduated from Amherst summa cum laude, went to Harvard Law School, clerked for Justice John Harlan at the Supreme Court after graduation. He is one of the country's leading practitioners in the areas of antitrust and commercial litigation, and in recent years has practiced before the Supreme Court on issues of constitutional law. In particular, Bert is the advocate for Abigail Fisher, the young woman who has challenged the application of the resort to racial criteria in the admissions process. And so I'm going to start this morning, or this afternoon, seems like morning, start this afternoon with a question for Paul. And that is, taking affirmative action in this context to mean consideration of race in college and university admissions, what is the justification at this point in time for that kind of practice?
Well, there are two potential justifications. The one that the Supreme Court has endorsed now since 1978 in the Bakke case is that it's justified as a matter of educational policy, that educators, in their judgment, are permitted under the Constitution and under the law to consider race as part of a holistic review of individuals aimed at achieving a diverse class where educational goals will be more appropriately achieved. And that is the terms on which this debate has occurred now since Justice Powell wrote the famous Bakke concurrence in 1978. Which ruled out consideration of the other potential justification for affirmative action in higher education, which is that some people in our society are members of racial groups that have experienced centuries of subjugation in this country, and that has left effects on current generations of potential applicants, both in terms of the schools that they attend, the economics of their families, and their overall ability to compete in admissions, and that by itself, the effects of hundreds of years of slavery, for example, plus Jim Crow on African Americans, would be a separate justification. That justification has been championed in recent years by Justice Ginsburg, for example, but it has been ruled out by the majority of the Supreme Court since 1978. So we focus primarily in these debates, at least in terms of when you're talking about the court and the law as opposed to philosophy and what you might independently believe, we focus primarily on the diversity aspect.
Right. Assuming that diversity is the justification, how do you articulate who the beneficiary is in that context?
Well, the theory, I think, of the diversity justification is that the beneficiary is everyone who goes to school in that institution, that it is not to benefit the minority applicant necessarily, although it's not to benefit the non-minority applicants. It is to produce an educational environment in which the educational experience of diversity is felt by all. And that is a view firmly held by the leadership of the elite schools in this country, firmly held by this college, which filed a brief in the Supreme Court in the Fisher case. I wrote another brief for most of the Ivy League schools and other elite schools. They are firmly committed to the view that they will educate better if they have a class that they can carefully admit, taking each individual person into account and taking race as one of many factors into account in deciding those questions.
And what has the court articulated as the standard by which lower courts should review claims for affirmative action?
Well, it does has articulated a pretty high level of justification that you require, a compelling interest, and it has to be a narrowly tailored interest. These are standards which actually are very often not met by a government when they're facing a constitutional claim under the 14th Amendment. But the court has held that the interest in educational diversity is a compelling interest, and that if you can show there is no other way to get that level of diversity and to achieve the educational goals that it produces, that is narrowly tailored and you can do it. And so in many ways what Burt was arguing about in the court in this Fisher case, the last two rounds up there, is whether or not you should continue to treat this as a compelling interest, and if so, is there some other way to get there? Is the race consciousness essentially necessary to get there, or is there some other way you can do it?
Burt, in your view and in your position in the court, does the Constitution foreclose consideration of race as a factor in the admission of student applicants?
Yeah, I think that, you know, many people tee the case up that way in the popular press and in people's concerns. That was not how the questions in this case were framed at the beginning, nor how they have carried through to the end. Because when we started the case, the prevailing precedent was, as Paul's indicated, the so-called Grutter decision, which said race could be a factor in an overall holistic, that's a word I detest, but anyway, review. So it's one factor to be taken into account and weighed against other factors, and that was not forbidden per se, but it would have to be strictly scrutinized by the courts. And the decision that put it in place then said, well, you know, yes, we recognize diversity can be in and of itself a compelling interest. You have to tailor it so it's truly a holistic review, but they said one other thing, or two other things. One, you can only do it if it's necessary to do it. That is, if your ability to otherwise generate a diverse class cannot be sustained. So if you have to show it's necessary and that there's no alternative, readily available, non-racial alternative that will get you there. And then the question is, where's there? And what the court mystically said in the Grutter decision was, you can do it up to the point of critical mass. Now, being good Amherst students, when we all had Physics 1-2, you know, in the ancient days, we knew that critical mass was when a reaction could be sustained in and of itself. The author of that opinion was not a scientist, thus leaving to the lower courts the question, when have you achieved critical mass? So in bringing this case and recognizing that the court was unlikely, in our judgment at that point, to be in a revolutionary frame of mind and really say yes or no, we began to probe at the question, has the University of Texas, which is the defendant in the case, satisfied the criteria of strict scrutiny? And in that, we said there are two points that we really feel have to be challenged. And one of them was the issue of critical mass, because the University of Texas was not an all-white campus. It was not a segregated campus. At the time of this young lady's application for admission, they were running about 25.8% minority admits, and that was a combination of Hispanics and blacks. They also had a lot of Asians, for reasons I can explain. So we said, well, you know, how do you know that's not critical mass? What prompts you to make that decision and declare that we haven't reached critical mass yet? So that's one dimension of what's been litigated in this case. How far can you go? Even if you can do some of it, can you do all of it? And when do you stop? And it's very, very difficult because from an administrative point of view, how do you do that? You say, you can't set a quota because that's per se forbidden. So you can't say we're going to stop at 15%. How do you determine that you're at, quote, critical mass? And Texas tried it, and we can discuss this in a number of ways. So critical mass became an issue. And then, you know, what is a reasonably available alternative means? What else could you do that would foster as much in the way of diversity as you're achieving today? And how would it match your goals? So in a sense, what we were saying is, look, we're not here today to say abolish it as such, but if you meant to have it strictly scrutinized, then you have to ask these questions, and you have to answer them on an established factual record. Just saying so is not enough. When this case came out of the Fifth Circuit Court of Appeals the first time, that court said, it's all on the good faith of the university. We don't know enough to be able to really do what that decision calls upon us to do. So the question we're going to test is the university proceeding in good faith, and will they tell us that they're doing what the Grutter Court said they should do? And that's when we first brought the case up and said, you can't do that. That abdicates the responsibility of the court. The court's got to face up to it. So in a sense, the justices have crept up to and back from the more fundamental question of the legitimacy of diversity as an interest. And certainly in the last oral argument, Chief Justice Roberts, for example, said, tell me how diversity contributes to a physics class, evidencing some skepticism as to whether that's the cause. Anyway, that's the dimension of the case. And because it's a court, my guess is they will still try to decide the case within the question presented and the framework that both parties are arguing about, rather than go to the ultimate issue. That's rarely done. It was done in Brown versus School Board, but that's a rarity. Courts like to proceed in a common law fashion, answering the question. But I suspect that those on the other side feel, if this court looks at this system and says it doesn't pass strict scrutiny, they will have set a precedent that ratchets down on strict scrutiny in a way that makes it extraordinarily difficult to carry it on.
Paul may have something he'd like to say. Yeah.
Am I not speaking to the mic? Okay. I thought this was a high-level audience.
Yeah.
Okay, I will not repeat what I...
It's old guys from the class of 61. Come on, Bert.
All right. So just to summarize, my point is that this is a case that was litigated to test in a factual setting what the court meant in the prior decision when it said, you may use this technique, consideration of race, to achieve a critical mass. What does that mean? And how do you look at alternatives in that pursuit? In other words, how do you define diversity so you can understand whether some different technique will or will not satisfy the concerns? So I hope that just at least put it in a framework and says, don't expect that you'll get a ringing decision that says either affirmative action is absolutely necessary and we must do it, or one that says it is unconstitutional in all circumstances, regardless of justification.
There is a particular aspect of the case that Bert hasn't mentioned yet. I think you need to fully understand what the case is about. The Texas system, when they first had a lower court decision, saying they couldn't engage in race-conscious admissions, what they did is they passed a system called the top 10% rule. And so what they do in Texas, and this is the system that is being challenged, 80% of the class at the University of Texas in Austin is filled by people who automatically are admitted. You've got to correct me if I get these things wrong. But are automatically admitted if they're in the top 10% of their high school class, and it's a high school in Texas. The issue that we're discussing here about diversity is about how you fill the last 20% of the class, because what the University of Texas does there is they act very much as if they were admitting people to Amherst or Yale or somewhere. They want to look at each individual, look holistically, and include among all the other factors race in that consideration for that 20% of the class. And in many ways, what Bert argued in the case was, you've got an awful lot of people of color in this university through the 80% and the 10% rule. So why do you need to consider race for the last 20%? And the system that they have there with the top 10%, what it does is it effectively exploits the high degree of segregation that exists in the high schools of Texas, where you have many inner city schools which are almost all minority students, and then you have many suburban schools which are much lower in their minority populations. And so as a result, you end up with a predictable degree of diversity, racial diversity, simply by the automatic rule of the top 10% rule.
Yeah, and I'd say there's, you know, any case of this kind, any debate of this kind entangles politics as well as issues of high principle. So Texas top 10 system is intriguing in the way it came about, because it did come about in a situation where in the so-called Hopwood case, UT had been told your pre-existing system of admission, which is just to look at academic record exclusively, predicted grade point average at Texas was the sole criteria, except race. And therefore, they adjusted minority grade point predicted averages by race. And they were basically having a target and a quota. But they didn't say it was a quota, but that's what they did. They adjusted. And the Fifth Circuit said, you can't do that. So when one reaction to that came from the university that said, then we have to broaden, in general, the admissions criteria, not using race, but using things that are race-sensitive, economic status, language spoken in the home, do you have to work after school? And that was part of their solution. But the Texas legislature was not satisfied with that. And that's when they went to the so-called top 10 system. And you might ask, how dickens did they pass that? Was there a minority majority in the Texas legislature? And the answer to that is no. But what it did, in addition to minority presence, it spread the geographic reach of the University of Texas. So the supporting coalition in the legislature for the top 10 is a combination of largely Hispanic legislatures, because there aren't many African Americans in the legislature, and legislators who are the most conservative in rural districts in Texas, who said, we have been paying for this miserable university for years, and our kids don't get in. And so its grip is dual. To students from rural communities, it's an opportunity that they could not have ever achieved on academic merit alone. For minorities, it's almost a guarantee. The other thing it did, and this is part of the complexity of the question all across the board, is the top 10 system radically increased the number of Asian American students at UT. And their imbalance, if you want to call it that way, is largely the result that 20% of their entering class are Asian Americans. And they come in largely, almost exclusively, through the top 10 system. It's very beneficial to them. And if you wanted to balance demographics, if you wanted to say the college classes should look like the high school graduating classes, that's about 42% Hispanic, which is the Texas population, there's nobody to squeeze out. You can't do it out of the African Americans. You really, there's not much left in the overpopulation of Caucasian students. It's about balance. You would have to take it out of the Asians. And that's an interesting question, because yes, you can say in diversity, I'll just shut up after this, it enhances everybody's education to have a diverse group. That doesn't appeal much to the person who didn't get in.
All right, now let me, Bert mentioned something that I want to ask Paul about, and that was a question that Chief Justice Roberts asked at the last oral argument, which is to say, what is the value of diversity in a course that is devoted to the hard sciences?
That question seems like it misses the point. The education of students in a four-year institution, whether it's here or the University of Texas, occurs not just in one particular class they're taking, but on a daily basis. Education occurring with respect to you learn from your classmates, and lots of other courses that students may take in addition to a hard science class. And so the reason why educational experts who run universities in this country think this is important is because they know that education is done that way, and that the best way to educate people is to build a community of diverse people with different experiences who can learn from each other's differences. That is the goal. And so I think the Chief Justice is an old friend of mine, is a smart guy, but it's kind of a lawyer's question, frankly, to say, what good is diversity in a physics class?
Can I give a comment on that?
I want to ask the question to you before you comment.
Okay, fair enough, Earl.
The question I want to put to you is, given what Paul just said and given the import of Chief Justice Roberts' question, isn't it fairly clear that there is value to diversity in a class, say, in American history or constitutional law?
Yeah. First, let me defend the Chief Justice a little bit. He doesn't really need me to defend him. But there's a context to his question, because when the university in litigation said, well, you know, how do you establish that your interest is not satisfied? They did a study of classes, small classes, and said, even though the numbers in the class as a whole are at 25%, when we look at smaller classes, they don't approach that. There are concentration problems that make it very difficult to diversify small classes. So they were talking about it valuable across the board as opposed to valuable in the class as a whole. So that was and so in part, Chief Justice was responding to that, saying, don't tell me that. It doesn't apply in all classes. So I think that's one element of it. Quite frankly, I've thought about this for a long time. You know, you're an advocate, so you're going to take one side. I mean, putting aside the things that lawyers like, mysticism, there are three principal thrusts in support of affirmative action. And one, as Justice Ginsburg really put it, is reparational. There are people who have been disadvantaged historically in this country. They were enslaved, they were segregated against, and we owe them something. We have to do what is right. So that, I think, is one concept that at least has a justification, but the court has rejected it. It says you can't remedy something unless it's happening today. You have to find it happening today, you can remedy it. So remedial measures don't count. So that justification drives some of this debate. Some of it is, I hate to use the term, but it's social engineering, and that's what, you know, in a sense, you're talking about. If we bring people together in different constellations and groups, we will get a better result. As colleges more and more withdraw from paternalistic ways to educate, they let the kids pick their own curriculum, this is still, to me, is a paternalistic element of the system. Now, there's a third justification, and that is you have people of great talent who, through disadvantages of background, don't demonstrate on fixed exams or grades the same capabilities we know they have, and we have to go and find them. Now, the question there is, race the tool that you use for that? Or are there other measurements? So, for example, if you take as an admissions criteria, do you have to work after school? Do you come from a family which speaks predominantly another language? You're saying the standardized measures we use academically may mask and underestimate the capability of the student. And there's a legitimacy to that that truly is independent of race. It looks at not what's your race, but how has your background, your status, your socioeconomic position affected your ability as a 17 or 18-year-old to demonstrate your full capabilities, and should we leave you behind for that reason? So that's a different...
Well, the third aspect that you talked about, it seems to me, moves away from what Chief Justice Roberts was talking about and doesn't answer the question I put to you, which is, isn't it fairly clear that if diversity, in the sense of let's have the best possible student body to give the best possible education, is the criterion, isn't it fairly obvious that you want as many different kinds of backgrounds, as diverse a class as possible, in a course in constitutional law or a course in American history?
I think that in a way that assumes the conclusion, because it's not clear to me that you couldn't have quite a a panoply of views regardless of the racial composition of the class. So to assume that you only hear it from a situation where you engineer the class is not entirely accurate. And as a price to be paid for this, I mean, certainly every time you intervene in favor of A in a fixed pool of opportunity, you are disfavoring B, and that is always a difficult thing to justify.
All right, let me change to a different, slightly different topic. What about the situation that the court finds itself in today with a, number one, a vacancy caused by the death of Justice Scalia, and number two, in the Fisher case in particular, the oddity of the fact that Justice Kagan was in the Solicitor General's, or may have been Solicitor General, at the time that the Fisher case originally came up. And so we really have not just not an eight-justice court, we've got a seven-justice court.
Correct.
And should the court be very leery of what it's doing here, should it say, well, wait a minute, we're gonna wait till we've got a full court, including, because if you get a new Democratic appointee and you get Justice Kagan participating, you go from 4-3 one way to 5-4 another way, and it's kind of difficult.
I think the court's going to be very leery of doing anything too broad by a 4-3 vote, because it's going to not really be worth the paper it's written on if they really pronounce, for example, they were to go even further than Bert asked them to go and say, you shouldn't ever treat diversity as a compelling interest in these situations. That would not be a decision that would last, you know, assuming Democrats win the election. Things could happen. But
things certainly could happen.
But assuming we get Justice Garland in November, as I think we're likely to get if the election goes in Hillary's direction, and assuming that Kagan's not going to be out of any of the other cases, it was only the Fisher case is the problem, then that would be a very different court than the one that's ruling in the Fisher case. And so what you've seen with the court with Justice Scalia gone is a reticence about being too broad about anything, and I think they will probably try to rule in this case in a very fact-specific way, either one way or the other, and focus on whether in this Texas has shown enough evidence, given their 10% rule, of a continued need to have a 20% of their student body admitted in the holistic way, to use Bert's favorite word.
Bert? Yeah, I mean, one hates to guess that way. The case the first time was known to only have eight participating justices, because Justice Kagan did sign a brief in the case on behalf of the United States in the Fifth Circuit. So she has been disqualified from the beginning, yet the court was willing to take it on. You could say, depending, if the case came out our way, that is, Ms. Fisher was the winner, I think that it would be hard to believe that she would have not won with Justice Scalia voting as well. So, in other words, if the four voters say Texas has not met the criteria, the only difference is with Scalia, there would have been a fifth, and let's say a more radical voice against affirmative action. So in that sense, I don't think the country would perceive this has been an artifact of Justice Scalia's death. It would not be. But saying that, I think Paul's right to say that if the court is concerned that the question will come back and then be answered totally differently by shifting majority, that's a difficult position for the court, because it politicizes the court. It says it all depends on who's president, and that's a very hard position. The Chief Justice particularly worries about that perception and the loss of the court's standing and credibility in the public. So, you know, there's some tendency, I think, to say whatever we do, let's address the case, and I think they will address the case, but let's not foreclose the issue eternally. I think the other side of that, and Paul may comment on this, is whatever this Grutter's case said in its very sophisticated strict scrutiny analysis, that's not what everybody read it to say. They read it to say, green light for affirmative action, go ahead and do it, just say, we're being holistic. This is only one of many factors. And who knows what would have happened if we didn't use it. it's the don't ask, don't tell policy of education. So, you know, I think there's a dissatisfaction with that, and they may reach for more definitive tests that would give better guidance to admissions officers dealing with large classes. Because,
The response I would give is that the briefs that were filed by the small liberal arts colleges headed by Amherst and the one that I wrote for Yale and Brown and a bunch of other schools that said, pointed out that clearly there is no alternative way to achieve this diversity for those kinds of schools, which have 30 or 40 times as many applicants as they have slots, and they don't have the 10% option available to them. They have international students applying, they have all these different things. The only way, realistically, to achieve the educational goal of a really diverse class in that kind of institution is to do what they have been doing since Grutter, which is use the holistic method. And I think that is something that the court needs to be aware of. If the alternative is they're going to make each one of these schools prove in court every year that they could have done it, they couldn't have done it some other way, and we're going to have this constant litigation over whether there's some alternative method, economics, considering the economics of the family rather than the race of the family or whatever, you know, what you're going to end up with is, I think, just a morass. And you have to ask a question: if you are, how is it you're going to completely not take into account people's race and ethnicity, if you're admitting somebody from the border county in Texas with a Latino surname, you're going to know they're a Latino from South Texas. It's going to be impossible for the admissions officer who's looking at that application not to, to have that awareness. And so there is going to be, that's going to be part of people's holistic review, whether you permit it officially or unofficially, it seems to me. And so, but I, so I, the goal that the Amherst brief and the Yale brief and everything we're trying to achieve was to tell the court things are working pretty well. You should basically leave things alone for those kinds of schools at least. Maybe the 10% rule is an exception.
Well, let me ask a follow up on that, which is how will the decision in Fisher affect schools like Amherst and Yale, private schools that don't have state funding, don't have state action, and how should the schools like Amherst and Yale think about this problem?
There is a federal statute, part of the Civil Rights Act, Title VI, which says that even though you're not covered by the Constitution, you're a private institution, you're not bound by the 14th Amendment. If you do things that a public school couldn't do because they're racially discriminatory, you will be held to violate the federal statute. So effectively, Amherst and the Ivy League and all of these schools that are completely private will be judged by the same basic standards as the public schools. The public schools are the government. They're governed by the Constitution. The private schools are governed by the Civil Rights Act. But the standards are the same. Now, Congress could change the standards as applied to the private schools, but getting into Congress to start talking about amending the Civil Rights Act of 1964 probably isn't a very good idea. So I think the standards are going to be the same for quite a while.
Yeah, right? And that's entirely accurate, and I think that's why the concern, you're not exempted. But Paul brings up another point, and that is whether decisions like Grutter, which come out of Bakke's fanciful version of Harvard admissions as truly holistic, whether decisions of that kind can really be applied by big universities processing large numbers of applications in a very short period. And there's a sort of irony. On the day that that Grutter case came down, the court also decided a case called Gratz, which Paul knows about. And Grutter was about a law school with a very small class, 112 in the class. Gratz was about undergraduate admission at the University of Michigan, where you're talking about 28,000 and handling, I think, 32 or 33,000 applications. Well, they couldn't, you know, use holism in the let's read this application and appreciate this person. Well, what they did is they had a whole bunch of factors that they said, well, that amounts to, we'd score them. And then they said, and in order to achieve diversity, we'll just give 20 extra points to minorities who've been underrepresented. And that will just level it out. We'll all be within the same system. We'll all be getting points, but some people will do better than others because of the 20, and the court said, oh, I can't do that. It looks too mechanical. Now, it's always going to be mechanical when you're handling that many applications in short time. And Texas is a real example because the top 10 system depends on 7 semesters of high school grades. So they cannot begin to process applications until they know who's in the top 10, because you don't want to look at those from the point of view of admission. So it's a very strange system that arises from a whole bunch of factors. But okay.
One of the interesting things that could happen here is if Burt wins this case on the theory that Texas has the top 10 rule and therefore they don't really need any more race-conscious admissions and they've achieved the critical mass through the 80% of the class that comes in through the top 10 rule, will that create pressure on all the other major public universities in this country to do the same? Because in most states in this country, if you apply the top 10 rule, you would get a fair number of minority students admitted because of the segregation in the schools that exists, not just in Texas, but everywhere. And so there would be potentially a division between the elite universities, who would continue to have the ability to do the holistic admissions, and this sort of hydraulic pressure to stop considering race expressly in these larger institutions, and they would all end up having to do what I think has been justifiably criticized as a terrible way to admit people to a university. Justice Ginsburg wrote an opinion saying, what a dumb idea is this? We've got a bunch of people segregated into all these other high schools, and we're not going to look at people as individuals. We're going to just look at the top 10% of that school. Is that going to get you the best student body for an elite university like the University of Texas at Austin? No. You end up with this rather arbitrary system where the people in the suburban school with much higher SAT scores don't get in. I mean, it's kind of a crazy system. And certainly educators, including, I'm confident, the educators who run the University of Texas at Austin hate the whole thing and would rather go back to an admission system which looks at individuals.
I'd like to open the floor now for questions from the audience. Yes, sir. Let me repeat the question. The question is how do you deal with the University of California system, which, as you suggest, and I don't know the answer, I don't know if you're right on this, that they get into the top 12% will get into a University of California school system, but just not necessarily Berkeley, or whatever their choice of school would be.
Yeah. I mean, that California does not permit racial factors in university admissions by amendment, so they're doing that for reasons independent of race, although all these things have consequence for race. So the answer to that is yes. No one says it's unconstitutional, and they have to sort because they don't have enough places at Berkeley to house all the students. Maryland does a lot of the same thing. Big systems are not unique in the way Amherst would be. They're processing a great many students and allocating resources. It is, I think maybe Paul Zabriz pointed out, a different world.
Yes.
In, you know, major university systems.
But this will be where you'll end up if they say you can't use race and where there's a top 10% available, that people are going to have to do more and more of it. Whether that is really race neutrality, it seems to be quite odd. You adopt a rather dumb way to admit people to the university, knowing that the purpose of it is to achieve racial diversity. Is that really race neutrality, or is that simply another way to get to a goal, but not as good a one?
Well, there's a record in this case that's very interesting. By UT's own studies, the top 10 minority admits did better in terms of grade point average, retention after 1 year, and graduation than the admits that they made out of the second decile at the higher performing schools. And you'd say, how could that be? Because the other ones had. And the answer, appears to be, educators would know more, is those are the kids that tried the hardest. They put in the effort. And this is a point that Judge Garza made in his dissent in the Fifth Circuit, the only Hispanic judge on the panel, said, look, I know that when you can do better than 90% of the people in your environment, you have a work ethic. And after all, it may not be true at Amherst or Harvard, but UT, elite as it is, if you work hard and if you're willing to slug away at it, you're going to do well at UT. And those kids do very well at UT because they come with a commitment to hard work. And one other thing I think that's left out of this debate, Harvard is being lauded here, but two things are true. One, it's being sued now because in its diversity goals, it has allegedly systematically suppressed its Asian student population because they have the higher SATs, they have the higher grades, and somehow they never get above 18%. And that's a question that's been opened Harvard. And the other thing, which is just a historical footnote, this system, holistic diversity, was invented at Harvard and other Ivy League schools to discriminate against people. That's why they did it. So you've got a system that was created for a discriminatory purpose now being lauded as the solution to adverse racial compositions. So it's a strange irony of history.
What?
Just to repeat the question, in case some of you didn't, he was espousing the view that it would have been simpler for Burt to win his case by simply arguing that all racial discrimination in admissions should be eliminated, that discrimination is discrimination, and that discrimination in favor of African Americans or Latinos in admission is just as bad as discrimination against them in admissions. And I guess I think that argument is historically inaccurate. If you go back to the 14th Amendment, it was passed in 1868 for the express goal of bringing the newly freed slaves into economic and social and legal equality. And the very Congress that passed it passed an enormous number of race-specific programs aimed at doing that, including the Freedmen's Bureau. They would be astonished if they thought that the Equal Protection Clause applied equally to programs that are intended to create additional movement toward a better society, a more equal society. I mean, admittedly, I'm invoking the justification for affirmative action, which is the historical justification of discrimination, the one that the court has ruled out since 1978. But that justification, in fact, I think is fully consistent with the historical understanding of the 14th Amendment, that there really is room for a double standard in terms of discrimination between discrimination in favor of the group that has run this country since the beginning and exercised the amount of discrimination they did against other people, and discrimination intended to, within limits, create a more equal society. Now, in terms of educational diversity, if you throw out all that stuff and say we're just going to look at educational policy, the question is it really makes sense to say we're going to continue to look at everything about people except their race and ethnicity, who their father was, what school did he go to, the same school, their athletic skills, their musical skills, their academic skills, everything about them, but not the experience that they've had of being a minority student in this country, and the particular challenges that poses to people, that it seems to us, on my side of this debate, and certainly to the educators of the most educators in this country, to be deliberately walling yourself off from one piece of the puzzle, but that is an important part of creating an educational community that will more effectively educate not just the minority students, but the non-minority students. It's for the benefit of all, as we said earlier on. So that's the response that one would give to that a really good question, just in terms of cutting to the chase, as you said.
Yeah. Well, interesting, Wyatt. I mean, you take a position very similar to the one that Justice Thomas has staked out. And he says in the 14th Amendment, it says equal treatment, equal is equal. And he believes these cases should be decided under Brown versus School Board. Because in Brown versus School Board, the court said the reason that you ban segregation is because separate but equal is not equal. And that's the bellwether. Is it equal? And I think just from a lawyer's point of view, a tactical point of view, that's an isolated view. It may be right. I'm not questioning right or wrong, but I think if you're asking how in framing a case at this level, I don't think it is a winner. It wouldn't have gotten certiorari on that basis because the court is, I think, unwilling to make that kind of straight principle decision. And even if you think about Brown, it took years and years of pawing through separate but equal evaluations under the rule of separate but equal is equal to come to the realization it can never be equal. And I think the same is true. There's always, in this kind of engineered class, an element of management. And there's always a question, if you're allocating an opportunity, what really maximizes it from an institutional point of view? What is the right criteria for admission? There have been fights over alumni preferences, for example. They were banned in Michigan because that may not be an appropriate criteria. And we've spent a lot of time as a society, and educators, Paul, too, worrying about what is the right answer? How do you allocate this very scarce resource? But I think if you say academic excellence, you've already answered three quarters of the question because that becomes your bellwether.
Yes. The question is to comment on affirmative action issues in public and private employment. Who wants to go first?
Well, I just say, from a legal point of view, the court's been very clear that that should rarely happen. You know, there they employ strict scrutiny and say you really have to show us something exceptional. And if you're doing it remedially because people have been held out of those positions, you've got to demonstrate that that has been the current reality. So I think in that field, because you don't have a compelling interest in diversity, it's very hard to be able to sustain that.
Right. I mean, I think that's generally true. I mean, the places where you still see these affirmative action in employment is situations like the New York City Police or Fire Department or something, where you have a long history of discrimination and a department which is vastly underrepresented of minorities. I mean, I'm not sure that these facts are still true in New York, but they certainly have been true in New York and other cities in the past. And the courts end up deciding the only way we're going to fix this situation is to set up a program of at least temporary affirmative assistance to people, not only outreach, but actually giving them a shot on the test higher than the non-minorities. And that has been accepted by the courts, but it is fairly narrow, as Bert points out.
Yes, back there in the... I'm sorry, I can't speak.
I couldn't get the second question.
All women's colleges. Okay, I got your question.
The question is, how do you justify all women's colleges? You just said it.
Okay. The first question is what evidence is there that diversity actually produces better education? And the second question was, how do you justify all women's colleges under this sort of criteria?
Paul, you should answer that question.
I'm not sure there's any way you could do an empirical research to show the benefits of diversity in education, because the benefits are not going to be that people end up having a specific measurable difference in their academic achievement or something from having a diverse community that they go to school with. It's going to be a whole set of attitudes and understandings and ways of viewing the world that are part of what's trying to be inculcated. So I don't know how you could possibly have a test like that. It is, however, the strongly held view of 99.9% of the people who run these institutions that this is a better place because of its diversity than it was when some of us went here and it was a lot less diverse. The women's college question, I think, is I'm not an expert in this at all, but my understanding is that there is a view that women will develop leadership if they have a place to do that where they're not in competition with men. And that is not a view that a lot of people still hold, but I think people have that option, do still want to exercise that option and go to some of those institutions, and I think a lot of people find them to be very useful. But in terms of how the law applies to Smith-Holyoke and Wells, I think there may well be a provision in the Civil Rights Act that allows that. I'm not sure, though.
Yeah, I don't know. Let me just, I'm going to interrupt for and say something myself for the first time.
Got all this expertise here. We might as well use it.
I went to law school about 3 years after graduating from Amherst. So I was taking constitutional law in 1965 when the Supreme Court was deciding an awful lot of issues about the constitutionality of the Civil Rights Act of 1964. And these were exciting and interesting issues. I had a very fine teacher in constitutional law. He had clerked for Justice Black. His name is Dick Howard. I admire him greatly, and he did his best. And the classes were pretty good. I came back to law school 22 years later and taught. And the first two or three years I taught, one of the things I taught was constitutional law. And we had a much, much more diverse student body at that point. There were a substantial number of African Americans in my constitutional law class. There were an even more substantial number of women. And we talked about, well, one subject was busing, which was the very controversial subject at that point. And this has nothing to do with my teaching ability, but we went on not only for an hour on the subject with lively and intelligent and powerful arguments being made, but when the class was over, there was no other course coming into the classroom where we were, and 2/3 of the class stayed an extra hour. Now, I thought that was an example of what diversity could produce in terms of, I think the students came out of there much more educated, but not because of anything I said. I'm sorry? Constitutional law?
I would only say, Earl, are you suggesting that Keith's sign saying 10 minutes remaining is invalid and people could stay an extra hour?
No. I've still got 6, 7.
Yeah, I think that measuring, by the way, I mean, people have tried in various ways to measure some of the, outcomes that are used to justify. For example, you will get a better class of leaders and executives because they've had experience dealing with diverse populations. It is extremely difficult to measure that. I think that there are no really peer-reviewed, we will look for them, documented studies of, 5 years later, how did diversity affect the outcome of your education? I don't think we'll ever know that. It's just too many factors that do it. I think even in women's education, there are arguments, but nobody's ever really figured out, are they true? I mean, that if you got to be president of the student body in high school, does that really mean you'll be a better member of the working force? It's really hard to measure that kind of thing.
I'm looking over at my wife who went to Smith. next question. The question, the question is that efforts have been made to show that there are benefits from diversity, and Stu, I think, says he finds those statistically unconvincing, but also that the way to obtain real diversity is to include things such as political beliefs and religious beliefs in the selection both of students and of faculty, and I'll give Paul the first chance on that one.
But I would actually just comment first. I think there's also been people trying to prove empirically that affirmative action is harmful to people, and they have these studies that purport to show that the minority students end up having a less successful academic career in the elite institution than they might have in some other institution. And I think those are probably also subject to major criticism in terms of their statistical method. And so there is a great deal that is hard to pin down in empirical sense about this whole debate. There's no question about that. In terms of whether or not diversity should include political views and religion, you know, I think there are limits to how much you want to ask people in their high school years what your political views are and that sort of thing. I mean, indeed, part of going to college is to have some of those things questioned and develop. And so I would think that a focus less on people's particular points of view as opposed to the other kinds of experiences they've had makes some sense. But it's an interesting point of discussion where diversity should stop in terms of what you actually would want to consider in the application, and what does it mean that you're not considering religion, as you say? That's a very interesting question.
Yeah, but interesting if you just look at the Supreme Court. you know, you have Clarence Thomas, who's an African-American, and Ruth Ginsburg, who's not. It would be hard to predict that they would add to diverse discussion in the ways that one assumes for this purpose.
Obviously you can't assume anything about people based just on their race or their religion.
But in diversity, if you're saying you're aiming for a different point of view and the like, an enriching discussion, you have to make that assumption because you don't know whether the person you're bringing in through the affirmative action is really going to be a factor in that debate or be a Clarence Thomas. I don't mean that pejoratively. It's just it is a difficult question. This whole area is interesting. For those in the class of 1961, and I may be the only person who remembers this, when we had American Studies 21, and it was after Brown, and a man named Herbert Wechsler, you may remember this, Earl, a law professor, had written an article which was critical of the decision, which is totally unpopular, called Toward Neutral Principles of Constitutional Law. Yep. And his argument was, When you just do right and you haven't developed a applicable intellectual basis for it, you will be litigating it forever. It will be chaotic. And in a strange way, I think this is true. We've been litigating the aftermath of Brown for, 60 years, trying to figure out What does it really mean? Are we anti-discrimination? Are we pro-equality in more than a formal sense, in a, you know, meaningful real-world sense? And as Paul said, you know, where do we stand as a country on the question of reparation? Because reparation is the easiest justification for people to accept popularly. We have to do something for folks who have been disadvantaged over time. It may not be the legal one, but it is the emotional driver on fairness. And if you want to face it that way, at least you face it. I think the problem with the current jurisprudence is it's concocted a theory of diversity that doesn't really speak to the hard issue underlying it.
All right, I think on that note, we will end. And I want to thank our two panelists today for a wonderful...